And now, live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, it's time again for your dose of action cinema history from the 80s, 90s, and beyond with the Lethal Mullet Podcast. Oh, get out of mine, there you go.
Recording live right now. Outlander of the Lethal Mullet Podcast. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, the Mullet, coming for you to... Let's just say I'm a bit tongue-tied, folks, because I'm tired. But I'm tongue-tied because we're chatting about one of my favourite films. This is actually a really good movie called Outlander. And here from Quinlan's Cantina here in the Gold Coast of Australia. And there you are. There's me. And there's, of course, our dear guest today. Of course, co-founder of the one, the only... Phantom Podcast Network. I've always called it the FPN. I mean, that's what we call it, don't we, folks?
Either way it works. It's all good. now you're tongue-tied because there's a Malwin standing behind you that you don't know about.
But this is true. And it's got a little baby as well.
Yeah. You don't want to mess with that. But yeah. I'm just going to say it was nice knowing you. You know what? Before this podcast is out, you're Malwin Chow. So...
Folks, obviously, if you're listening to the show, you know that this is a podcast covering all great action cinema. Obviously, we catch everything from the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and beyond. You know, we did a whole lot. And this one's obviously a little bit closer to our time. This is came out in 2009 in Australia, 2008 elsewhere in the world as well. And it's a great film, directed by Howard McCain, and it stars JC himself, Jesus Christ. It is, of course, Jim Caviezel.
No. The truth of the matter is, the movie we're talking about is Jesus Christ, Alien, Alien Creature Hunter. You know.
Oh, whoa, folks, look at that. Is that a Lethal Mullet coffee cup? Oh, sorry, keep going.
I said my piece. You know, if you're going to fight aliens, no better chance than to get JC on your side.
Oh, 100%. And Hellboy. That's right. Ron Perlman's in this one as well. And, of course, John Hurt.
Yes. This movie actually has quite a cast. Mm-hmm. You got Sophia Moyles in this cast as well. You remember her either from... Most remember her from either her role in Underworld or in mm-hmm. Doctor Who. She had a pretty big episode with David Tennant run that was quite popular.
Good old David Tennant. What a great Doctor Who he is. He was fantastic.
Oh, he was. In fact, he is coming back as Doctor Who for at least the 60th anniversary special.
All right. I've got to do the prerequisites of joke here. Who? Who?
Who? Who? Who? Dan Hadley. That's who.
Dan Hadley. Hello, Mr. Hadley. How you doing, mate? You're out there today? We very much want your company on a deep thought episode here, all the way from Brummie to Australia. Yes, no, of course, tonight... yeah, we need it. Don't panic. He's got his towel. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has many a thing to say about Deep Thought. And Deep Thought itself has many a thing to say about the guide. Who are going to give you a guide through the maelstrom and enormity of the guide itself. Hosted by two unexpected travelers, the Lethal Mullet, all the way from Quinlan's Cantina in the Milky Way, and of course Dan the Man from Birmingham. All on the other side of the water, they have hitched a ride and come to Ursa Minor. Tell you all about the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which you can find whenever you find good podcasts. That's right, folks. Check out the brand new show, Deep Thought Life, Douglas Adams and Everything, monthly on, of course, the Lethal Mullet Network at lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on the socials at The Lethal Mullet. You can also check it out on YouTube very soon on the Spacebook Network, hosted by the one and the only co-host here, Dan the Man from Birmingham, Dan Hadley. All here. And don't panic, we'll be back. As we talked about, obviously, we're doing this film tonight, folks, and...
You know, we put out some interesting episodes over the last couple of weeks with Lee Fillingsness, the co-host, of course, of the Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast. And we've been covering, you know, things like, obviously, Heat, one of the great films of the 90s, and one that's definitely put Michael Mann back out there in terms of the crime and, you know, violent suggers of things like, of course, Miami Vice, which I'm going to be covering here soon, folks. And you know what? I just happen to have the case with me. This is how old mine one is. It's the original DVD copy.
And of course, some serious 80s neon pink on that, too.
Oh, it really is. And you got to love it, folks. It is awesome. Don Johnson, Philip Michael Thomas in the house. And, of course, Eddie James Olmos as the captain. He never smiles.
I can't think of a movie. You know, very few films or TV shows where I've seen Edward James Olmos smile.
BSG, bro.
Yeah. I have a few moments there, but there's a lot of stern faces, too.
Oh, yeah. What's interesting too is it's great to revisit some of these series and, you know, just get a taste of, particularly, Miami Vice got a lot of starts of careers of, some really great actors. Jimmy Smits is in it, in literally the first episode. We also get Bruce Willis in an episode where he's an arms dealer.
Yeah. Very, very young Bruce Willis. Miami Vice was one of those shows in that kind of early 80s through mid 80s. That was a place to go. And if you could get your attention caught by being on an episode of Miami Vice, it was going to catapult you. Or if you were a superstar during that time, you wanted to be on Miami Vice, i.e. Sheena Easton.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But the thing is, it's so stylish and so well shot at the time that actual series still holds up. I mean, I'm watching some of it now, and I mean, yes, it is as old as it is, but it holds up, to be honest, better shot than you know, one of my other favorites, Magnum.
Magnum. And speaking of which, on Magnum, the new Magnum was actually rescued from its cancellation at CBS and will be on the Peacock network, streaming network. Ooh. Here in the U.S., which I know Mr. Norman C. Lau is very happy about.
Big shout out to Norman. We did this also in the Cobra Kai episode. I want a big shout out to Norman, not only for what he's doing, you know, obviously with Star Trek right now with his podcasting. He's doing a fantastic job over there, but also he's doing some great work keeping fit, amazingly fit, I may say, Norman. So big shout out to you out there, bud. And obviously too, his He-Man that he's been doing over the last, you know, couple of years has been fantastic, and it's really got me into wanting to learn different types of martial arts and swords. And particularly now I'm doing historical European martial arts. So I'm doing, European blades, which I haven't really ever done before. I did saber, and now I'm doing broadsword, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been working on my King's Blade made out of strange spaceship craft metal, you know, but it cuts through anything. It's better than a Ginsu.
Nice. Well, folks, before we get into anything here, whether it be the news or, of course, the film of the day, which is, of course, this bad boy right here. That's right, Outlander. We're going to quickly let you know how you can catch this podcast and many others like it. Of course, you can see it down in the little ticker down here saying check it out at lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com. You can also check me and, of course, all the other stuff that I do on socials at The Lethal Mullet. We do everything from obviously chatting about these stuff, but also really enjoying films you haven't seen or TV shows you haven't seen before, pop culture, and of course, quite a bit about martial arts as well. Kyle, where can we find you in the FPN?
Of course, you can find me on the FPN, all over the FPN, as being one of the co-founders. Of course, visit our main page at fpn.podbean.com. Visit our YouTube channel. Now that this guy's on StreamYard, we're actually going to get him on our YouTube channel, so hopefully we won't get banned too quickly, but we'll get a few episodes out. We're the Phantom Podcast Network. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, all your major podcast catchers, including this guy popping up on that feed every once in a while.
G'day, mate. How you going? Welcome to the Lethal Mullet Network, where you'll find all these amazing shows and more. Where you'll find the Lethal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of action cinema from the 80s, 90s, and beyond. You'll also find Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, where I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Mark Newbold, into a deep dive of Star Trek. You'll also find Mullet and Kilt, a look at music, where I'm joined by my dear pal,
Darth Elvis. And where you can also find the Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe. All here on, of course, lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on your favorite podcatcher. You can find us there. You can also find all these shows a week later on, of course, the one, the only Fandom Podcast Network, FPN, on fpnet.podbean.com. Don't forget to also follow us on socials. There's, of course, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at the handle at the Lethal Mullet. We'll catch you out there and enjoy your action cinema. And now it's time for the news here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast.
Wild, oh, yeah. Too. So now I do need to ask you a question, sir, because I know that you just recently recorded an episode about Top Gun Maverick. And it came out on digital here in the U.S. the other day. Been a busy guy. I mean, you know, I'm keeping things going here, editing, recording shows. And of course, I have a real world job too. Got to pay the bills. You know, unfortunately, podcasting doesn't pay for itself. But I got to get your impressions. What were your impressions about Top Gun Maverick? Because it's been the biggest movie of the year so far. I mean, it's up there. I think it just passed Endgame, not Endgame, but Infinity War is like the sixth grossing, highest grossing film of all time.
It's the second greatest movie of the year. I will say that it is the second greatest. Big shout out to the team at the Paper Tigers. Your film is better than Top Gun Maverick. I've said it a number of times. That film resonated with me more than any other film since Dune came out in 2021. Mind you, I did see that a little bit later.
I gotta hold you up here because Paper Tigers technically came out in 2020.
Yeah, but not here in Australia. We didn't get till much later. So technically, I got a technicality on you there, mate. Yeah.
Freaking COVID and time travel.
Yeah, true. But getting to it, Top Gun Maverick has one of those few things that many other sequels have done here and there. Empire Strikes Back might be one. First Blood, to a certain degree, might be one. Maybe even T2 for some people, where it is actually superior to the first film. Now, having said that, this really is one big movie because you really need that first movie. It's got so much backstory to get into this. And I've had a number of fans listening to this podcast who it's their first time watching a Top Gun, and they go and revisit the original. And the fact that, you know, a lot of those aerial stunts were done by real planes, or in this case, jets, F-14 Tomcats, and just everything resonated. And it didn't matter whether you were our age, really going with, of course, Maverick's journey, but also the younger crowd, the next generation after us, are going with the Top Gun, you know, returnees, the people that are coming back that are still, you know, in their 20s and 30s. So it's an interesting story. Obviously, Goose's son, big part of it. It really is a heart-wrenching story, but a fun one too.
Yeah, I think for me, what worked about it so well is I thought it was one of those films, and it's been a trend that's been very up and down, I think, in Hollywood films, is it's a film that does pay proper tribute to where it came from. It recognizes what came before it, unlike other film franchises that seem to have a problem of finding the balance of, oh, we need to pay proper homage to where we came from. But, you're not going to necessarily give the people what they want with it either. We're going to still kind of do our own thing. But Top Gun really does it. I think my only issue with Top Gun 2, and I throw it out because it's the type of movie it is and you're just enjoying the ride, is it got a little ridiculous at the end with, you know, it just happens to be an F-14 there, all that kind of stuff. I'm not going to go into too many details in case there's people out there who are watching or going to watch this later.
Yeah.
Spoilers, but they kind of pushed the envelope there. But again, it's one of those movies where it's a Hollywood theater. It's a classic Hollywood, see it in the theater, blockbuster film. And that's something we haven't had in a good while. Thank you, COVID.
No, not for a long time. You know, the funny thing is, you know, there's been movies that have got close to it for me. The hit and miss movie, I think, over the last year in 2021 was The Matrix Resurrections. Now, I actually really enjoyed that film. You know, because not only was it in some ways a love letter to Keanu and obviously Carrie Ann Moss's characters in this new sort of new age coming through, it was also poking fun at the Matrix in kind of the way that Top Gun Maverick is also poking fun at Top Gun. And it really is. Like, it's interesting how you got both sort of coming through the lines there where, you know, there's commentary on the rebooting, you know, bringing back the old and, you know, what would they have done better? All that sort of stuff. Kind of like a time travel story to a certain extent does. Top Gun Maverick does that really well too. But this is where I bring in the Paper Tigers, because the Paper Tigers plays with a similar idea with martial artists that were, you know, our age. There's, you know, they're past their prime. They don't have the abilities that they used to have, but what they do have is wisdom. You know, with age comes wisdom. And I think that's really great in this sort of point. You know, you could kind of look in hindsight of where things are. And that's exactly what is done in this movie. We get to see Tom Cruise play, you know, somebody that's kind of like a bit more like the Paul Newman characters we were used to in the 70s and 80s, you know, all these great films which were all about wisdom. Because really, you look at it, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is, you know, the reason the Butch is so good is because wisdom. He's smart, he's clever, he outthinks his, you know, ways through. And this is exactly what Maverick is good at. There's some great scenes in it, especially the start with Ed Harris. It's great to see Ed Harris in this kind of take the lead in it too. Yeah, what did you think of the cast?
Oh, the cast was phenomenal. Really, everything that worked about this was phenomenal. And of course, Jennifer Connelly's on a whole other level by herself. But I mean, no, the cast, it's a phenomenal film. And I do think, it, in my opinion, as far as just blockbuster films this year, it's number one as far as the blockbuster films we've had this year. However, and this is my other question for you, Mr. Mullet, before we get started on Outlander, because this is something Kevin and I just recently talked about on the episode of Culture Clash, of what's coming still this year. And we've got two films I'm very intrigued by. One, I think, could end up being the biggest movie of the year, and that is Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. Now, I also think this is in part because of the emotional impact that this movie is going to have on people because of everything with Chadwick, which still hurts me to this day. But the other movie I'm very curious about your thoughts on, at least right now as things stand, is Avatar: Way of the Water.
Well, we've just seen on Disney Plus, if anyone's got a Disney Plus subscription, you'll know that Avatar was pulled from there over the last week. You know, JC himself, James Cameron, decided to basically redo the film. Now, what I mean is he's cleaned it up. He's given it a bit of a touch up, and it apparently looks amazing. Not that it didn't look amazing already. It looked amazing.
Yeah, I have a piece of news that part of that is because it's getting a theatrical re-release in September.
Yeah. So I saw that. Yeah. So sort of obviously getting us geared up. Obviously, the other thing I've done is a bit of looking around. There's merchandise on the way. So we're talking about everything from, you know, T-shirts, all the paraphernalia, but also it's got a lot of, you know, kids' action figures and toys and stuff like that along the way, computer games. And there was also the, I don't know if it ever got released, James Cameron was also doing a prequel novel to lead us into Avatar. Kind of like he looked at, likened it to The Hobbit. You know, it's leading us up to this trilogy, or now I don't know how many films he's got planned in this. But what I really would like to say, James Cameron, look, I'm looking at the camera now. Mr. Cameron, you are doing a fantastic job on Avatar. I think it's great that, you know, somebody's spending 10, 12 years, whatever it is, on these films and producing an amazing story, great technologies as we go through it. But where is the Abyss Special Edition? Where is my True Lies Special Edition? All in HD. Should be 4K by now, mate. Come on. Do us proud. Get it out there.
Yeah, that's an issue with Cameron right now. I find it fascinating because I look back at like when Avatar first came out, and I remember so many people, it was so hyped and so many people were walking out and so many people were blown away by the visuals. I mean, it was one of the first really an IMAX in a regular theater film. The 3D was spectacular. It still holds up to this day. I have a 3D TV and can watch it on Blu-ray on 3D, and it still holds up pretty damn well.
The depth is amazing. Yeah.
For the 3D. My question is this, though, because I really feel like we haven't had that huge technological leap since that Avatar.
Yeah.
You're taking some of the wow factor from this film. And let's be honest with you, as much as I enjoy Avatar, I think it's a solid film, but it's the storyline premise is a very cookie cutter storyline premise. Let me put it that way. It's not bad. It's just, it's not what I call fully original either.
Cameron's stories have always been interesting, but they're very basic. And, you know, he's influenced by, you know, some very strong things that obviously we all know. Avatar is a story that's been told before. well and truly. So in some ways told better in other ways, but visually looks stunning, you know. And the same goes for Aliens, you know. Aliens is a horror movie at the end of the day, that he did. And obviously even Terminator is pretty much like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And by the way, I put a post up a little while ago about Terminator and the successor Terminator. I think the biggest thing that they got away from with those films was the fact that they forgot that they were horror films. They're not action films.
No, you know, they're not.
It's a, if anything, it's a horror movie on the road, you know, and it should be treated as such.
Yeah, no, I agree. So now, sir, can we talk about Outlander? Because I have,
we certainly can.
Very, very important. I want to bring up here.
Okay, cool. Because, all right, folks.
Go ahead.
Hi, mate. How you going? Come on in, mate. Yeah, yeah. What shall it be? Oh, yeah, man, it's been real busy day, you know. Oh wow,
right,
yeah.
Like,
hey, yeah, yeah. It's just like I was telling my mate the other day, you know, have a nice, you know, cold beverage, and enjoy the show. Here you go, mate. Here, enjoy this beverage and enjoy this film chat.
All right, folks, here we go. So, Outlander, which is this bad boy right here, folks, came out in 2008/2009, depending on where you are in the world. It stars Jim Caviezel, Sophia Myles, Ron Perlman, Jack Huston, and, of course, John Hurt. This is described as Alien meets the Vikings, or, you know, some type of Viking film. It is meticulously made. It's a beautiful film. Shot in Nova Scotia, and it really looks the part. This is a film which shows us not only the culture of the Vikings, but also a culture of Kanan, played by, of course, Jim Caviezel, this alien, human alien that crash lands on Earth in about 709 AD, and, of course, has to bear in mind that he basically has to learn Norse and survive, as he's brought with him a mythical creature called the Morwen, which is a real alien beast who basically is out for his blood because his people wiped them out. And, of course, they're one of the few that are left. The whole story is actually based around the myth, of course, of Beowulf and Grendel. And this is an interesting take on it. If anything, it's actually a more realistic take than even Robert Zemeckis' one as well, because I believe that this one really keeps that sort of vibe up. Other films that have done that well, probably The 13th Warrior, better known as Michael Crichton's, of course, Eaters of the Dead. Now, you have something interesting to say about this one, too.
Yeah, I got a couple things. First off, you mentioned 13th Warrior. On Culture Clash, Kevin and I have a thing where we will have a segment every once in a while where we'll make VHS doubleheaders. You know, where you didn't really record on 6 hours because it would kind of the quality of film. But you always put two movies. You always got that two movie. Mm-hmm. You find a couple two-hour movies. A great VHS doubleheader is the 13th Warrior and this film Outlander on the same cassette.
Oh yeah, yeah, it would be too.
And if you wanted to throw it in as a triple header of Vikings with in weird places or with weird matchups with them, you throw in the movie Pathfinder with Carl Urban.
Oh yeah, well, you know, believe it or not, Carl Urban was actually up for the role of Kanan before this.
Mm-hmm. But this film in particular, Outlander, is very interesting because I think it's a very underrated film.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing of it is this film has so much that was edited out of it that would have, at the time, if they would have put in even just a quarter of what they had, this film would have been a totally different film and a really, really good film. But this was at a time when, you know, they were trying to edit it, keep things under a certain point. And this is when they thought this is when Jim Caviezel was having a moment and they thought his name would just carry the film without a problem.
Oh yeah. I mean, he's done a lot of great stuff over the, you know, the years. Jim Caviezel, obviously, probably most known for Mel Gibson's, Jesus Christ and the Passion of the Christ, but also, you know, he's done some great things. He played the son of Dennis Quaid in Frequency, this great film about, you know, a father and son pulled apart by time, obviously. And through a CB radio, they're able to communicate with each other. And it's a really touching film. Now, I've always said this, as someone who's lost his father when I was young, which is me, to be able to talk to your father again in some manner like that really touched me. So that when that movie comes on, it's a very tough watch for me because I get those feels. But the great thing is the acting and he really is an interesting actor. Now, I liken him to also his father in that role, Dennis Quaid, because Dennis Quaid had a crash landing movie, alien style one, just like this, a little bit happier, Enemy Mine. And this feels like his Enemy Mine moment, but he's learning about a culture too, just like Dennis Quaid did.
I don't know if I can call Enemy Mine a happy film.
Well, it's a fun film. Like, towards
the end of it, don't get me wrong. I'm a fan of that movie. That is a great 80s classic film.
Garbage.
But that is a very dark film too.
And Louis Gossett Jr. just owns the role that he has in that film. I mean, you know, when they become friends, which is actually pretty quick in the movie, really, because it's not that long a movie. But, you know, and he's, you know, just the lovely, he says, Davich, you know, like he just stirs the crap out of, you know, the work. And of course, the director, sadly, has passed away in the last fortnight, which is, of course, the great Wolfgang Peterson, who also directed one of my favorite movies, Troy. Great film.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, you have that. But getting back to Outlander, I mean, this is one of those movies. I saw it in the theater, actually. I did go see this movie in the theater just because I was excited about the concept of it. And it's one of those movies when I walked out of it, I was like, I like this, but I felt like there was so much more potential here. And really didn't get to learn that potential, as you just recently discovered, until you got a copy of the DVD that had deleted scenes on it. And my friend, you just got the special edition copy and you got a lot of deleted scenes.
I did. Yeah, 100%. So this is the original edition that I've already shown you, which came out in 2008, 2009. Now, Australian distribution or companies out here have a real thing about putting out bare bones editions, everything from Warner Brothers, Paramount, Fox, whatever it is. With these guys, Momentum Pictures, they put out this lovingly beautiful UK edition, which is apparently the US edition as well. Yes. And this is a beautiful Blu-ray. It has that many features. I know you can see on the screen there, folks. But anyway, I'll read them out. So it's got not only a feature commentary with producers, writers, obviously Hal McCain himself, the director as well, deleted scenes, which it feels like they go for about at least an hour, maybe 90 minutes. And it really brings out the tapestry that should have been in the film. It's just an absolutely glorious, you know, extension of some of those scenes, isn't it?
Yeah, and the really big thing about those deleted scenes, it's not so much the deleted scenes that take place on Earth that they cut out. It's all of the deleted scenes involving Caviezel's character of Kanan, with his getting a little bit more of the backstory of his race, and hit the experiences they had on the planet of that they invaded with the Malwins on it, and how that went. And you actually see how his family gets killed. You see, you see that what leads to the events of the opening of the film. It, to me, if you add in those factors, it just makes that character of Kanan that much more interesting and that much more depth. And I really, really wish this movie had at least gotten some of those scenes back in, because I think it would have just, it would have upped the level of this film. I think this film would have stood out a lot more under those circumstances.
The running time is 115 minutes. This really relatively should be at least, 2.5 hours. I think you would have been easily able to fit a lot of that material in there. And the great thing about this is that it does open up a little bit better. Now, the original opening to this film, we'll get into the story in a sec, folks, was meant to have a burial at sea of a Viking king. And what's great about that is you actually get to see the culture of that, you know, which we've kind of seen in actually 13th Warrior opens with that to a lesser degree. But with this one, then it would jettison the camera straight up into the orbit, and we would see Kanan's vessel coming down, a Morn attack on the ship, the captain getting killed. Or in this case, they actually were going to keep the captain alive. He was just going to be wounded. And then, of course, a crash landing of that ship. So we're going to get to see a lot more of that alien culture. And I think that's great. Look, the best thing about it is we get to see that. There's a really good Outlander behind the scenes featurette. We get to see the producers and, of course, directors' perspectives on what they really wanted to do with the film. Compromises they had to make. Obviously, the budget ran out pretty quickly on this movie. But the other thing, too, is they wanted to film it with Rennie Harlan originally in New Zealand, which is really interesting. Maybe that's why Carl Urban was picked up first as an idea for the role. With that too, we got artwork galleries. They're really good. You get to see a lot of the concept art done by some of the guys that used to work at was it Star Wars, Lucasfilm. So yeah, Ryan ILM. Church, Ian McCaig, yep, ILM people, yep, that's right. And what's great is it, also Patrick Totopoulos worked on Beast as well, and it's the Morn, which is an interesting sort of cross between. I actually think it, some of it looks like a little bit like what we'd see later on in the panther-like character in Avatar.
Yeah. But
I think the Morn's really interesting as a design, using light to track it and trap its prey. You know, you get inquisitive to see what this light's like, and then it just unloads. The only thing I will say about this film, I still to this day, after watching this edition of it, and it's beautiful and everything, is the way that the Morn uses tentacles out of its mouth and stuff like that is a little confusing. I think it needed to be simpler.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the early times when we see the Morwen and it's fully colored out with a lot of heavy red at that point. I think it takes away from the look of the creature, because it becomes kind of just this, because of just the way effects were at that time, and they still hadn't really figured some of this stuff out yet. The Morwen almost becomes like this red blob on the screen at a couple of
points. 100%.
And it's really confusing. And then when you finally get a good look at the creature, when it's not lit up and you just see the creature itself is really sharp looking and really cool and a really great design. And you, it makes you wish they would have been able to figure out how to do the lighting a little better.
Yes. I mean, sometimes, lighting doesn't need to be that dark, even for a film, which, is influenced even by Jaws. You know, they're using ideas out of Jaws in this, particularly the Morn was meant to be seen at the start. And then obviously they realized they couldn't do it. They didn't have the budget to even do the attack on the ship, so they had to change that. But with that, folks, let's tell you about the story. Okay, so this, as we mentioned before, sitting around about 709 AD, Earth is a seed colony to basically a very advanced human alien civilization. And they're currently getting attacked, by these creatures called the Morn. And as they go around trying to eradicate the Morn basically destroy their colonies and stuff like that. One of them gets on board a ship by two soldiers, one of them played by Kanan, another one the captain of the ship. And as it heads towards Earth, a seed colony, they basically get attacked to the point where the ship crash lands. And it crash lands is in Norway near a place called Herat. And in this, the only real survivor is Kanan. Kanan is basically a soldier on the ship. He's somebody who's lost his family to the Morn attack on his own planet. And from here, he has to basically survive on an Iron Age Earth. And it's one where, obviously, he knows nothing about. So from here, he gets captured by a character who's basically is soon to be king, if you like, of this society, played by Jack Houston. Jack Houston, you might know from Boardwalk Empire. He is related to Angelica Houston and Danny Houston. So quite a famous family and a great actor. He's really good in Boardwalk Empire. He plays a veteran of the First World War and does quite a brilliant job actually in that role too. And this one, he has to play pretty much the up-and-coming king. He's got a lot of attitude and quite tough. And from here, he basically brings Kanan into the camp captured. And Kanan is mistaken to be the killer of another village of people. And, of course, this is Gunnar's village. Gunnar is played by Ron Perlman. He is basically the rival Viking leader. From here, we meet John Hurt, who plays Hrothgar. Yes, Hrothgar, just like in Beowulf, folks. Same idea. And of course, he doesn't know what to do with this character, this Kanan. They straight up think that he is the one that has killed the next town. And from there, they want to find out some answers. And of course, Kanan tells them that he didn't, that he's hunting a dragon. From here, we get to see not only Kanan become engulfed in the Viking culture, but he also leads these guys to basically hunting down the beast. There's mayhem, there's murder, there's, of course, more hunts for the aliens, and we get to see a really interesting take on the Viking culture. Beautiful sets and everything, and, of course, massive Morn attacks. That is as much as I'm going to tell you if you haven't seen the film.
I'm about to get attacked by a Morwen behind me, apparently.
Looks like you got a couple of Morwens there, by the look of it.
Yeah, they're infants. I'm not too worried about it. the thing about this movie that I really like, obviously it did play up a lot on the Beowulf thing, but
yes,
and it pulls a lot of things from the 13th Warrior as well, where, you know, you see Kanan in this society he's not used to and kind of get pulled into it. But one of the things I really liked was he developed that bond with the child Eric
in this film.
And it's obviously Kanan had lost his son in a Malwin attack and his wife. And so I found that real interesting. And I liked how the kid bonded with him. And you see the kid eventually, you know, cut his hair so his hair is shorter, like Kanan's as well. And of course, too, we got to bring her up, is the absolutely gorgeous Sophia Miles as Freya in this. And of course, she's rocking the red hair, which just, you know, makes me, you know, melt right there. I mean, she was beautiful as a blonde.
She's great in this.
She's redhead, but she's such a strong female character too. Even when she's kind of the maiden in peril, she's not necessarily the classic maiden in peril. She got more of a Princess Leia. I'm strong. I can take care of myself kind of thing. Yeah.
As Jack Huston's character says, you know, as Wolfric says, he says, there's nothing soft about her. She's tough. And that's exactly what she is. She was great in also the Ridley Scott produced Tristan and Isolde, which was a few years before. Great film. So let's talk about the cast. Obviously, Jim Caviezel, person of interest, I believe, is probably the most latest thing he's done on TV or whatever it is, which is, I do believe that was produced by Christopher Nolan, or at least the Jonathan Nolan, maybe.
Yeah, early on, of course, you know, at this point, though, let's be honest with you, Jim Caviezel is riding high thanks to Mel Gibson at this point.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, and there was a lot of stuff he was coming out in at that time. Obviously, Sophia Miles. Now, John Hurt's an interesting one. John Hurt coming to this, you wouldn't expect him doing a Viking film, but, you know, how do you predict? Because he's done just about everything. He's done Alien, obviously. I think that's one of the reasons they tried to get him, is because the Alien sort of angle too. But, you know, he's done everything from Renaissance films to this to one of my favorite roles he did was in Contact.
Yeah, no, he was very good. I just want to throw out too, if you're a Caviezel fan and you're interested, he did a movie in 2002. He did a new modern remake of The Count of Monte Cristo, which I know Kevin is a huge fan of.
Great film. And Guy Pearce is in that.
I think it's a highly underrated film myself. So. Mm-hmm.
Oh, 100%. What I love about that film, too, is a certain great actor going, just the speed, as he's trying to teach him how to do the fast rapier work and stuff like that. And of course, amazing actor, Richard Harris.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Richard Harris is absolutely amazing no matter what he does. So.
Oh, yeah. So, folks, let's have a look at some of the other casts. We've got, obviously, Ron Perlman playing Gunner in this. He's fantastic. They talk about him all the way through to about halfway through the movie when he actually turns up and attacks the camp. And he looks like a Hell's Angel on steroids.
Yeah, this is an interesting point in Ron Perlman's career too, if you look at what he's doing around this point, because he's still kind of a little bit in that guy mode. Oh, it's that guy, you know. But it's also he's gotten some he's gotten some noted writing because he's been around for forever, but he was becoming that kind of that guy for the new generation of movie watchers because he had just done some of the Hellboy work, but he was really still kind of, you know, he was behind. I mean, it was a couple years. At the same time he did this, he had done Hellboy 2 in the same year. So.
Oh, yeah, and arguably it's the better film. I mean, I've always liked Hellboy, but Hellboy 2 is just bang on perfect.
The Golden Army. Now, it's a such a shame we never got that third film to wrap up that trilogy.
You know, and it's too late now. Like, it's just not going to happen now.
Yeah.
So we've got Aidan Devine as Ionar. We've got Katie Bergen as Sonya. We've got Cliff Saunders as Boromir. Now, Boromir is probably my favorite role in this. He gets all the choice lines. He's the funny guy. Without a doubt. And that's what I love about it. It's just really well placed.
No. Well, let's be honest with you. You want to hang out with Boromir because he's always got the mead.
Yes. It's good old mead. You know, I love that. You know, what kind of backwater are you from? Like the way he's kind of playing it. Oh, I don't know. It's a kind of an Irishy Viking sort of feel to it. You know, Cliff plays it so well, but he gets all the best lines, even later when they're digging the ditch. He goes, what are you waiting for? Get into it. You know, he really is.
Are we done yet? Party. Are we done yet? No, four more feet. and then post holes. Post holes all the way around. Well, what do you need post holes for? Well, posts, of course.
Posts. Oh, it's brilliant. But I mean, yeah, this is the great thing about this. You really do live with these characters. You know, Wolfric as well, who's, you know, you kind of, he expects to be king. He's got that youthful sort of thing that he, you know, it just should be given to him. But not only does he become what he should, as John Hurt's character says, Hrothgar says, he says, it's not about how you, you know, lead the others. It's about how you mind your head and your heart. And he does that at the end. He literally, I mean, he sacrifices himself for not only, you know, obviously the people, but for his town.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if we're going to be honest, this movie borrows a lot from the 13th Warrior too. It really does.
Big time. Of course it does. But then again, Michael Crichton did exactly the same. I mean, his whole point with writing that story originally was to make Beowulf interesting. He said, because there's that famous thing where they said that he had a friend of him say, oh, all literature is boring. He said, no, I can make that interesting. And he did. And it's a fantastic story and a fantastic movie. You know, even the fact that he grounded it by bringing in the reality of the start of the film was an actual event that took place.
Yeah. And, you know, but for me with this film too, it's the interesting twist of adding the sci-fi element to it, adding the alien, it being an alien, and obviously having Jim Caviezel be from another planet as well. And they were the kind of feeling responsible for bringing the Morwen to this planet. One of the things, though, with this film, even in the Blu-ray quality of it, and I'm curious if you noticed that, did it feel like it was filmed grainy? Like there's a little bit of darkness and graininess to this. That was, I think it was an intentional call by the director to kind of give it that feeling, but there are times where it really works against it.
You know, they, I think in the commentary, if I remember right, I do want to listen to it again, but there's influences of aliens in there, even the smoky sort of grainy quality of some of the scenes where the Morwen attacks. But there's also little bits and pieces where he's trying to pull from Spielberg as well, with, you know, the hesitation before something actually comes through and hits, whatever it is. But yeah, there's sort of a grungy quality that McCain, you know, kind of a dirtiness sometimes to those, but I think it actually adds to the horror.
Yeah, I agree. But my feeling was too, there was a couple of scenes where it was broad daylight and they were trying to use that, and it really kind of just, it felt like it worked against it. And I think it definitely worked against it a couple of times when we see the Morwen and the Morwens is going the full color route. That should have really been vibrant and clear. And I think it would have helped with that aspect of it.
That's where you need to throw your budget into those shots. You know, there's other times where they could have just done a miniature or something like that and just, you know, pulled back from it. I don't know, whatever you want to do. That's where practical always comes out better.
Yeah, absolutely. So my question for you, though, is what were some of your favorite? This movie does have some really interesting scenes in it. What were some of your favorites in this film, Mr. Mullet?
The first big one for me was literally when they go on the hunt and they kill the bear. Not because it's interesting. We get to, as we go up, especially if you've seen the deleted scenes, you can see the kind of like the stone, I think, of Odin's face. And they're dropping off trinkets to give basically, you know, a good luck, if you like, on their hunt. So that's something that was left on the cutting room floor that should have been kept in there. But as they go along, we meet, obviously, Boromir, and then Hrothgar has a good chat to Caviezel, and he gets to know them. And it's that sort of Star Wars-like thing where you're off doing something, you're learning about the culture and the people as you go, instead of just sitting there and going, right, there's a Jedi, there's this, there's that. In this case, you know, you're learning about them, and, you know, whether it's, in this case, hunt. They're going out on the hunt. And Caviezel's keeping all these cards close to his chest because he knows these guys aren't going to believe some spaceman. And it also shows a bit of a character of Jack Houston's character as well. After the killing's done, we get to go back to the big hall, and, of course, they play shields. So they put the shields up, and that's the second greatest scene because
That scene's high up there for me as well.
So good. I mean, like, there's, isn't it?
It's so fun, and it's fun as you watch. Caviezel plays it really well as he's trying to, as how his demeanor changes as he figures out what the game is.
Yeah.
And then
100%.
what's so good about it is between the hunt and his success in that game, he earns the respect of the village, and especially of the people who now see him as an equal. And it really shows going forward. And, you know, I even get the little comedy moment where it ends up where he has to do the flip and he's landing on Boromir and so you get that the shield splits on him. But yeah, I think that was one of those great moments in this film where it really, that's when it starts turning the corner and becoming a more united front.
Oh, without a doubt. This is the best thing about it is the building of characters' relationships in this really shows. And it's through how they're doing that, you know, like, and it's just great writing. That's what's really done it. For me, the other one is, of course, when they do the final big hunt and down below and try and obviously save Sophia's character as well. Look, the film itself has some real golden moments, but they're the ones that always stick out for me. And even some of the flashbacks to Kanan's culture and stuff like that, which, believe it or not, what they're speaking is actually Norse, which makes sense because they seeded the colony. So it's kind of like they're the alien engineers, if you like.
Well, you know, and this is the thing with this movie, too. There's some really interesting aspects when you kind of get past just the main thing of the alien and everything like that. You've got this Christian priest in with these Vikings.
Mm-hmm.
And they play up some angles with that are kind of interesting with that. And then, of course, you know, you talk, but again, I come back to it. And Adam, this is a movie, and I'm going to say it reminds me of Kingdom of Heaven in this aspect. Mm-hmm. Kingdom of Heaven was a good film when it first hit the theaters. It was a better than average film. But then the director's cut come out, and it's just a superior film. I mean, the director's cut for Kingdom of Heaven is just amazing, much like the director's cuts for the Lord of the Rings films. This is a movie so could have benefited from that director's cut and just become such a good film. And this is one of the cases where this is a smaller budget film. It didn't get, I remember it initially got a lot of hype and then it just kind of disappeared for a while. And then it just came back and it was just kind of thrown out there. And then it just, you know, you just feel it especially when you go back and watch the deleted scenes on the DVD, you're like, gosh, if they would have just thrown the Odin scene and some of these early scenes on the planet, this film just carries so much more weight and it clears up some of the questions you have. And it just doesn't feel quite. One of the things about this film that's always been a little bit of a knock for me in the regular cut is that it feels a bit rushed. Like everything's just happening. Bang, 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 bang. And it's like, you would have liked to have seen a little bit more development in there. And I think that's where the deleted scenes really would have benefited this film.
I think there's enough in those deleted scenes to at least make, you know, a film which, you know, now, if you released it now, it would be just as good. I would have liked to have seen maybe a bit more of Kanan's culture. You know, I think that, you know, like a full-fledged maybe prologue would have been good. Even though, you know, they say don't show the beast off. I think it needs it because you need to have that threat of what this beast done to his entire planet. You know, it's multiplied, it's killed everything out. But only after what Kanan's done, you know, his people have done as well. But also, Kanan's gun's freaking cool. They did the right thing and got rid of it because imagine he turned up at the camp with that thing. They'd be really thinking he was Odin himself.
See, this is what I would have liked to have seen, though, with this. And this is something that this is one of the nitpicks I have with this film is that I wish they would have incorporated a little bit more of his technology into the film. And there was a way to do that. You know, I always go back. This is something that I've always gone back to. I think it's a great way of how they've incorporated the good guys fighting the bad guys that have the advanced technology was V, the old miniseries. Because, you know, Mark Singer, who really for so long was the only one who had a visitor's weapon. You know, so he kind of stood out a little bit more and was able to do more damage because he had a visitor weapon. But I think if you would have done that here, where maybe Caviezel hides the weapon, and then when he goes back to retrieve the metal to create the sword, he finds that weapon too. And if nothing else, if he doesn't use the weapon to defeat it, he has it and maybe it gets destroyed in the process or something like that. But just to incorporate that in a little more, in his technology a little bit more, I think would have been a little beneficial to this film as well.
Oh, 100%. You know, I think it's an interesting take. The fact that it is something that probably wouldn't have worked is the metals that space age race were using were well beyond something that Iron Age Vikings could even smelter. Because, I mean, there's no way they could have got the the furnace hot enough, you know, to get this metal in there. You can't do that sort of metal. It'd be like going from 3000 BC up until, you know, 1000 AD when the first katanas were starting to, like, or the tachis were coming out.
Yeah.
You can't fold steel like that with the heat back then, with bronze, or even, you know, it would have been before bronze, you know. Yeah. Technology advances like that. Nah, rubbish. But it's a movie.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of things that are a little rubbish, but it's a movie, is when they entrap the Malwin for the first time in the pit and it blows up, and like they're like right there at the shockwave, and it's the one guy's covered in the oil, and yet he doesn't even catch a spark.
Yeah, doesn't catch a smark of fire. Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, we're pushing it here, little guys. But again, that's just okay. It's Hollywood. You just roll with it.
What's the most unbelievable part of the film for you?
I think the most unbelievable part of the film is that explosion. I really think that's just, there's a lot of defying logic in that. Again, but this is the kind of movie where you throw that aside. I think there's a lot of stuff, though, that was quite believable, and like how they had the Malwin hunt, how it came up through the second one, the child came up through the well. I think that we hit on the two most unbelievable aspects of this are, yeah, there's no way they forged that sword. And unless he had something like he maybe grabbed some fuel from the ship or something to really get hot. But otherwise, it's that, and it's that explosion. I mean, you know, everything else I thought they handled pretty well. Mm-hmm. And I think I the only other thing I can think of is I really do believe that the Vikings would have probably been a lot more superstitious after they had seen the Malwin for the first time.
Oh, 100%. And the thing is, like, they are superstitious. You know, they believe in, you know, obviously multiple gods. Is this one of those multiple gods?
Yeah, exactly. So, but other than that, you know, like I said, this is one of those films. It's a fun film. If you have it in your collection, you probably picked it up on the cheap. I picked it up off iTunes for like $5.99. And it's something you're going to be flipping through. You're looking for something to watch, and it's going to kind of pop out there, and you're just going to play it. I mean, it's just
100%.
And you enjoy it. And then you kind of forget about it for a while, then it pops up again. But it's one of those films. It's like, oh yeah, that movie. Oh, I need to go pick that up. Or I don't. Or, you know, oh yeah, I've got it. Let me pull it out. And, you know, Rice has probably got five different copies of it sitting on his.
Oh, he's probably got it on Laserdisc.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what I say. If they made it in Laserdisc, he's probably got it. But all kidding aside, it's a great little science fiction film. Mm-hmm. It does what it needs to do. And it comes from that era where they were just kind of throwing some stuff out there. They weren't necessarily giving it the love it really should have gotten, but it sneaks through as having a little bit of quality to it and being a fun film. Is it going to be something that you're going to just say, oh, this is a must-see film? No, you're not going to say that. But if somebody asks you, give me something a little different to watch, Outlander.
Outlander. All right. Well, it's time, folks. We've got to let you know what we think of it in the Hell and Back scale. That is, of course, finger scale. I think it's a rip roaring 4 out of 5 for me. You know, again, if you put those scenes back in, 5 out of 5. What about you?
I'm going to give it a solid 3.5 out of 5. I think there's just it's a product of its time, and it could have had a lot more love to it and been such a more superior film. But you get your fun out of it as well. Mm-hmm. I think it kind of falls, like I said. I would rank the 13th Warrior a higher film than this film. Obviously, I think the 13th Warrior is probably one of my favorites in that kind of genre, what I call the Beowulf genre.
Yeah.
But I think this one is a fun ride. I think it's one that's kind of lost to the annals, and then pops. Like I said, it'll pop back up every once in a while, and you're like, oh yeah, that movie. It doesn't help that, of course, the success of the TV show Outlanders kind of really made this thing kind of get lost in the ether as well.
Oh, yeah, but, just by name.
Yeah, just by name. It's just one of those things. But yeah, no, this is if you're a fan of the genre, if you like the 13th Warrior, you like a little science, you want your little 13th Warrior with a little science, more science fiction with it, this is a great film to go with.
It really is, folks. And like I said, get the newer edition if you can. It's fantastic. It's well worth your time. Folks, we've come to the end of it. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Go and check this out. We've got another Cobra Kai one coming out, part 2 of our Cobra Kai, with, of course, Lee Vilgazis of Blood of Kings up there with, of course, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. That's right. Of course, on the Phantom Podcast Network. Great show if you like Highlander. And of course, Kyle, you've got a lot of content coming our way on, of course, FPN.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. We're talking right now on our True Believers MCU podcast. It's all about the She-Hulk. One of the most fun things I think Marvel Studios has done in a good while. And it's really a nice refresher from some of the things, the heaviness we've seemed to had with Marvel for a while. I'm a huge Tatiana Maslany fan. I've loved her since Orphan Black. She's phenomenal in this. Kevin and I, of course, do our Culture Clash show, which we try to put out every couple of weeks. We just kind of talk about what's going on in fandom and what's happening right now. I think we're going to be having a little fun with the Predator franchise here shortly, talking a little bit about the success of Prey and maybe a little bit of the history of the Predator franchise as well. Also, too, we have Time Warp. Right now, we're covering the films of 1982. We just recorded our part of our summer of 82, so we've got a lot of the big hits from 82 in there. And, you know, we've also got our Couch Potato Theater, which we always have a ton of fun with. Kevin was just kidnapped by the Pink Ladies, and they did Grease 2. He survived. He survived. But, you know, you got to let the lady, when Mrs. Reitzel speaks, you got to listen.
Yeah. No, this is 100% right. Well, folks, enjoy. I hope you definitely check out some of the other shows on the FPN. And, of course, Lethal Mullet Network, plenty out there for you to check out. We'll be here this time next week with, of course, much, much more. And, of course, Silverado is next week's episode going out on the podcast channel, followed by, of course, Cobra Kai and this here one, Outlander, the week after. Enjoy. Good afternoon, good evening, good night. And, Kyle, thanks for being on.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU Podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. The Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.